Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Mike the Gardener podcast, sponsored by those lovely people at Natural Grower, who supply plant-based products for both organic and chemical-free gardening and your houseplants. Well, I'm so excited today to bring you a somewhat different episode of my podcast to mark the end of the first series. The last 15 months have been very difficult for most of us at some point or another. And for those of us who are lucky enough to have gardens of whatever size, or a patio, a balcony, or access to a local park, being outside at one with nature and tending to our plants has been a saviour. And so today, I'm taking you all to the beautiful Waterperry Gardens in Oxfordshire, where I'll be talking to my friend Pat Havers, the head gardener, Simon Buchanan, the managing director, and Chris Lanchak, the fruit consultant. So, whatever you're doing, enjoy the next 50 minutes or so as we kick back and enjoy the sheer beauty of Waterperry Gardens.
Are you ready for this? How about the greenhouse with all with all the pictures, the orange tree? Well, you can go in the house.
Wherever's best.
That'd be quite nice.
To talk about the history.
Yeah. Very good. We can see some of his work in the gardens, which is...
Yeah, so wherever you'd like. If you want to come up to the ballroom and see the ballroom, for instance.
Ballroom it is.
Might be worth seeing it.
Yeah.
I'll be in the garden somewhere.
So fine, yeah. That's just brilliant. Fine.
Come and find me. I'll probably be near the herbaceous border.
Good afternoon, Simon. I'm with Simon Buchanan, the Managing Director of Waterperry Gardens. Thank you for inviting us here today.
Thank you for coming.
To start with, can you tell me what your job is and what does it actually entail? What are you responsible for here?
The title I was given, rather than managing director, is actually steward. The only other steward I know is the steward of Gondor, and he jumped off a cliff. I quite often feel like doing that myself. So I look after the whole estate, the 80 acres of the estate, which includes being managing director of Waterperry Gardens Limited. It also includes looking after this big Georgian house and the residents on the estate. We've got about 7 cottages on the estate and the people that live there. So I look after the whole shebang, really.
And so how much of your time does that take? Because that doesn't sound like 9 to 5 to me.
It does take a fair amount of time. Even when I'm not busy, I try my best to look like I'm completely frazzled and busy all the time. It does take a long time. It's a 7-day-a-week job, really.
So how many people do you have reporting into you to help you? Because you're not doing that single-handedly. Who reports into Simon Buchanan?
I've got managers all around the estate. So I have Rob Jacobs, the horticultural manager.
Yeah.
Pat Havers, the head gardener, who does a great job out there. Chris Lanchak, who looks after the fruit department. A shop manager called Mike, who looks after the shop and the retail section, Nikki, who looks after the tea shop, and my wife runs the gift barn as well, Jenny.
Okay.
So there's all sorts of managers here. The staff, the sort of payroll, we've got about 80 members of staff. That probably equates to about 40 full-time members of staff on the estate.
Now, there's a lot of history behind Waterperry Gardens. Can you tell us about some of the history behind this wonderful place?
Well, the house has only been owned by 3 families over the years. So the first family mentioned in the Doomsday Book, which must be like, I think it's 1068 or sometime like that, were the Fitzillies. So they were a medieval bunch. And I think they were given the estate by the king.
Okay.
And they had it up until about 1580, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next family who had it were the Curzons, and they were wool merchants, I guess. So wool was the big money maker of the day.
Okay.
And they built really what you see here today. This Georgian house, the sort of front grand bit and the Queen Anne porch. And then after them came the Henleys. And they were a shipping family. Apparently, the eldest son of the Curzons, he lost a lot. He was quite keen on gambling and one spin of the dice too many, and it went. So then the Henleys had it, and they had it up until sort of the 1900s. Then they sold it. They sold it to Magdalen College. And they had it for a little while until Beatrix Havergal came along. And she was looking for a place to start her school for young ladies. She'd started her school down the road in Pusey.
Mm-hmm.
And it was getting bigger and she wanted to expand. And she thought the Waterbury looked like the perfect place. So apparently she came with Avis, her second in command. And while Avis distracted the board of Magdalen College, she went off into the gardens with her gardening fork and dug the earth to see what it was like.
Oh, okay.
And the earth here is fantastic.
Yeah.
It's light loam and it goes down. I mean, I've dug it in the gardens. It just goes down for, you know, a couple of yards.
Oh, I'm jealous already.
It's amazing. And so she decided this was the place for her. And so she started her gardening school here. And it went from strength to strength, went through the war years, and she got help from the land army.
Yeah, I remember seeing that, yeah.
She got given some extra land out in the Westfield. The Westfield was given to her as well by the government, I think, and they dug for Britain and dug for victory and all that sort of stuff. And she eventually bought the estate. I think she got given a bequest.
Mm-hmm.
And she had it, and her gardening school flourished right up to the 1970s.
So how long, when did she actually start the school? Was it about 40 years before that?
Yeah, that's right, 40 or 50 years before that. So I think she came here in about 1938, off the top of my head.
Okay.
And yeah, continued from there on. And of course, she's famous for educating lady gardeners in what was very much a man's world in those days.
Yeah, I was going to say, she was really ahead of her time. It must be very difficult for her back then to say, this is what I want to do. I want to have a horticultural school for ladies. Incredible.
Yeah, she was a statuesque figure.
Yeah.
With a stout heart. And she was really imposing. If you see pictures of her, she's like head and shoulders above the rest of the girls.
Yeah, I have seen pictures. There's one particular picture of her. I wouldn't want to be on the wrong side of Beatrice Havergal.
Yeah, she must have been quite amazing. You know, she played the organ in the church next door. But apparently everyone really loved her and really respected her. You know, she did things like showing her Royal Sovereign strawberries at Chelsea every year and winning all the gold medals.
Yeah, she won quite a few gold medals, didn't she?
Yeah, I think it was about 30. I think one year they got a silver and I just wouldn't have liked to have been on the team when that happened.
Yeah, on medal day, you don't want to be near Beatrice when she got a silver.
No.
So the school obviously went from success to success. What happened towards the end? It was in 1972, did the school come to an end?
Yeah, Avis died.
Right.
And I think Avis was a big part in Beatrice's life.
Yeah.
And I think she'd got, you know, she was fairly elderly by then. And I think she just decided it was time.
Mm.
So she looked for someone to sell it to. And she had a couple of organisations that were interested. They were both sort of philosophical institutions of some sort or another.
Mm.
And she decided to sell it to the School of Economic Science as a retreat centre. The reason she chose them is because she went and looked at one of their buildings, and the first thing she did, of course, is she went straight off to the gardening shed, but when she saw that their tools were well oiled, it was sold to them.
Oh, as easy as that. Done deal.
Yeah.
So, fast forward to the current day, you're managing director here now. How do you decide how to take the gardens forward? Because I guess there's a respect for the history that Beatrice has created here, but of course you want to keep it fresh. So how do you tread that fine balance between history and going forward?
That is a really difficult one.
Yeah.
So I've only been here for 6 years, which makes me very much a new boy compared to some of the rest of the staff that, like Rob, I think, has been here for 25 years. Chris has been here for 40 years.
Yeah.
Pat herself has been here for coming up to 20 years, I think.
So
my first step was not to jump in with any sort of avant-garde ideas and say, because I'm just a stone carver, I don't know much about gardening at all. So I've spent the first 5 years at least just trying to learn about the gardens themselves.
Mm.
They're things that just become really obvious that need doing. So simple things like just making sure that the herbaceous border, our very famous herbaceous border that was started by Beatrice Havergal, is, you know, that they have the funds to properly feed and mulch that in the winter.
Yeah.
Which hadn't really been happening up till now. So where it was really needed, and you could see what difference it would make, I just made sure the funding was there for that kind of thing. Other things, like in the main sort of cross drags of the gardens, there's some cord and apple trees that, you know, are getting pretty long in the tooth and stuff like that, and some of them down on their bellies. Just deciding in consultation that we had to replace those, and where the best place was to go. And to actually, one thing I find quite easy to do is to think about the structure and the kind of backbone. I can't really do the flowery bits. And I'm full of admiration for garden designers because, you know, as a painter or a sculptor, you're dealing with a fixed palette. You've got this fixed set of colours, and that's what you're dealing with. And that's kind of like, that's difficult enough as itself.
It is.
Imagine if your palette was changing 3 or 4 or 5 times a year in front of you as you were painting.
Mm.
And not only that, but the canvas that you were painting on was changing and being eaten away in the corners, and and like animals were running across it. And
it's just a tough one, isn't it?
It's a really tough one.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's just... Yeah, gardening is an art form, as something that's just dawned on me as the years have gone past. Knowing what to leave, knowing what to take, knowing what to develop, knowing what and heights, different heights of things, just that in itself. Leaf forms, textures.
There's a lot to it.
You know, as a designer, I would have thought you just scratch your head and think about the flower colour, but there's so much more to it than that. And so much that's changing all the time. It's fascinating. So Rob and Pat have been my kind of teachers in that area.
Yeah.
And I've gone on garden visits, and I've had the privilege of talking to sort of head gardeners like Fergus Garrett, and really sort of them bringing home to me the sort of the joy of the artistic side of it. So the thing I've relished about the job is the education, the unexpected wealth of knowledge that's out there, but also the awesomeness of the fact that you could never know it all.
No.
You just couldn't know it all,
could you? It's impossible. It's impossible.
So I spend some time, you know, I concentrate on things I could get my head around. Like, so I've finally got some real idea of, you know, rootstocks of apple trees and what will work and what won't work.
Mm.
And so I try to concentrate on the sort of nuts and bolts side of it, and leave my skilled professionals to deal with the sort of the bit that the customers really notice and make so much difference.
Yeah. Obviously, we're coming hopefully towards the end of a very difficult year and a half, which must have been very difficult for the garden as well. For all of my listeners out there, what is it that they need to come to Waterperry to see? What are the main attractions from your perspective?
I think... what you get from Waterbury Gardens is so much diversity in a relatively small space.
Yeah.
So you've got 8.5 acres of formal gardens. If we're just going to talk about the gardens themselves as the attraction, and there's way, way many more things here, like a museum and a church and a wonderful tea shop with homemade cakes and the orchard and all those things. But if we just concentrate on the gardens, I think you could choose to come here 4 times in a year and almost see a different garden each time you came.
Yeah, that changing palette again.
Yeah. But I think it's just that mixture of the formal and the informal, which is so attractive here. So you could walk down the Virgin's Walk, go past the wonderful amphitheatre, and we sometimes have shows on there and stuff like that. You could turn left there and go down to the most tranquil and shady of river walks down there. Or you could turn right there and go up past this stonking herbaceous border, pure herbaceous border, which is looking great now, early, like definitely 3 times in a year, and see a different border.
Mm.
And that's amazing. So I'd say, get a season ticket, man. And come here 4 times a year. Come in the winter and see the structure, the backbone of the garden. See Kevin's amazing hedge cutting, which he practically uses a laser level for as an ex-builder. And it's just so fine and so neat. So come and see the structure in the winter.
And you have the snowdrops in the winter as well, don't you?
Yeah, then come in February. Maybe there's more seasons.
Yeah,
come a bit later in February. See all the snowdrops sort of washed over the more informal part of the garden.
Yeah.
Come a bit later on. We've got a fair amount of narcissi now. So March, come and see them. And then just come all the way through till in September, October, where you've got, you know, our famous asters
yeah.
and all that stuff chucking there. the blues and pinks and stuff out there on the border too. And then in October, the garden's got a lot of fruit growing in it as well, so you get all that colour and the fruit dripping off the trees everywhere, the pears and the apples. And then a bit later on, we're not so much of an arboretum, but we do have some nice liquid ambers and things like that out there for later.
For the autumn colour.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it's a knockout garden all year round. Well, used car sales, wasn't it? Here I go.
Well, five, 6 years down the line, there's definitely a gardener coming out of you now. Oh, thank you for your time this afternoon, Simon. I'm really looking forward to going out and seeing the garden myself. Thank you very much.
It's a real pleasure.
Thank you.
So we're outside the back of the kitchen now. And then we can sneak through the back gate and down the border. Sneaking down.
Beautiful. Perfect day for it.
Pat and I made friends on Instagram over a year ago, so it was an absolute delight to finally meet her and see the garden which she and her fellow gardeners are responsible for maintaining.
Well, this afternoon I'm here at Waterperry Gardens with Pat Havers, who is the head gardener in this beautiful garden. Pat, it's absolutely wonderful. I'm looking at the herbaceous border. How long have you been here?
Well, I've been here in the gardens probably over 20 years now.
Wow.
Can't really remember, but I've been head gardener for about 11 years. So
what's your very first memory of being at Waterperry?
My very first memory, well, actually, I can't really remember it, but there is a photo of me asleep in a wheelbarrow when I'm about two. So my mum used to work here and she used to bring me up in the pram. So all of my childhood is just around about Waterperry. So there is this black and white photo, but I do try not to sleep in the wheelbarrow now.
So what did your mum do when she was here?
She worked in what was called the marketing yard. So she would be sorting vegetables ready to go to the shop, which they had in Oxford, the Covered Market. So they'd take all their excess flowers and vegetables and sell them there.
When you first came to work here, what was your first job? What were you doing?
My first job, I can remember, is weeding. And I thought I'd done a really good job, and then the head gardener at the time said, it's really good, but I'd like every weed out.
Oh dear. We all love a bit of weeding, don't we?
We do, yeah.
So how long did you do the weeding for before you then start to get sort of promotions?
I guess I did it for about 10 years.
Right.
Didn't really have any sort of great intentions of, you know, doing anything else. I just loved my job. And then when the head gardener's job came up and they interviewed, they realised that most people coming didn't know as much about the gardens as I did.
And of course you learned about plants by doing the job.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I was very lucky to have, you know, lots of lovely people to help me. And also Mary Spiller was still here, so she took me under her wing, and I think when she finally retired in her 80s, she was happy to pass it over, because I guess I'm probably the last Waterperry girl, really,
right,
to be sort of know Miss Havergal and know Mary and know lots of the people.
How did Mary Spiller fit into the Waterperry Gardens? Who was she?
Well, Mary came as a student in 1942, did her Waterperry diploma here, worked in the gardens. She went off for a while working in other gardens and then came back as a teacher and looking after the gardens and designing bits of the garden.
So you were working alongside Mary,
yeah,
and you learned much about plants doing the job.
Oh, definitely. She was a fantastic teacher. She was also the first female presenter of Gardeners World.
Of course she was. Yeah, I remember that now. How long did she do that for?
I think she did it for a couple of years.
Yeah. So what does your job actually entail? What are you actually responsible for as head gardener?
So I'm responsible for the day-to-day running of the garden. So everything in the gardens, all the borders, all the grass, everything else. Health and safety, looking after the staff. I do social media, all sorts of things.
And how much of your time is in the garden and how much is it doing the admin side of the job?
I would say I don't do a lot of admin. I mean, I have to do all the labelling, but I mean, vast amounts of my time are in the garden, so working alongside the staff and you know, looking after their needs and making sure that they're not, you know, that they're okay, really.
And talking to the staff, how many gardeners have you got working here alongside you?
Well, we've got, I've got two full-time, well, there's three of us, so two other full-time members of staff, and then we've got various seasonals at the moment that come in a couple of days and help us out.
And obviously the training that Beatrix Havergal put in place all those years ago is still an important part of Waterperry now, isn't it?
It's a massive part. So with Rob, who's the horticultural manager, we are just adamant that we're keeping the traditions of those ladies that have gone before us. So every time we're thinking of doing something, we always think back to the ways that they would have done it and what they would have thought about it. So that's always forefront of our minds.
Looking at the border in front of us against the wall, how does the planting look so immaculate, Pat? It's just pristine.
Well, this border is my baby. I mean, the whole gardens is, but this is particularly. So we keep to all the traditions that we've been taught by Mary and by Beatrix before, and everything is staked, which is how we've been taught to do it. So it's staked with hazel, which we cut from the estate end of February, beginning of March. We store it somewhere cool because we don't want it to dry out and become too brittle. And then we cut it to size as we need it. And I try to stake things when they're about half to two-thirds of their final height. So we're getting the staking over the top, and then it gives them time to grow through and to look quite natural.
And you have Alison working in the border there now, who's been with you for 5 years. So she's going through this process now.
Yep. She's been my apprentice. And she normally says to me, can you just put them in, the first one in, and get the height? And then she finishes off, which is actually good that you can do a job together where you can start it and someone else can come along and finish it, which means that hopefully I've taught her well.
Exactly. So do you have a duration of time that you train people in? Does it take sort of like a certain amount of years?
It does take quite a few years, so that, which is really nice for me when I've got someone that I can call on, you know, to help to do it.
Yeah.
It's not something that you can put just anybody on. It has to be, they have to practice in other parts of the garden before they, you know, get their hands on on the border, because, you know, this is the showpiece. This is what people
see. It's such a wow factor when you walk around the corner. There's so much colour in the border. You've got geraniums, you've got geums. Do you keep to the same planting each year, or do you mix it up a little bit to keep it fresh?
We do. If something dies out, we will try the odd thing differently. If we have to move something, we will. We do a lot of lifting and dividing. But generally, we like to have, you know, all the things that are popping at the moment, like the geums and geraniums, we like to have a certain amount of those at the front of the border. And so they're staked so that when the flowers die, you don't have to cut it right down. So so we would never Chelsea chop on there, because you don't want any parts where the foliage is right down to the ground. But the staking holds it up to the end of the season. So we've got a long way to go till September and October when all the asters come out.
So talk us through the season. What within this particular border, which is looking stunning now, how will that change over the course of this season?
So we start with alliums and lupins and geraniums and geums. Then it goes on to what we call the delphinium period. So the main plant on there is the delphiniums. And then we go into asters.
Beautiful.
So, I mean, aster, September is just amazing. It looks like a patchwork quilt of colours.
I think that's the nice thing. You can see, looking at that border, that it's going to change so much over the season. But how do you cope with plants that go over?
Well, they're plant with the three seasons, so you can plant early things at the back as long as you've got something later in front of it. So anything that's gone over at the back has gone down, like eventually the delphiniums will go down, but there's all asters in front to take their place, so there should never be any holes. If we've done our job right, there's no holes there.
Well, I can't imagine that you haven't done your job right. Looking at the border now, there's just so much colour. You've got the interesting textures, the different heights in the border as well. And what's that on the back wall? Is that that red rose?
Oh, that's Dublin Bay. We've got Dublin Bay this end, and then we've got Crimson Conquest up at the other end, and then Lady Hillingdon in the middle. But Dublin Bay here will just flower and flower and flower right till the end of the year.
So talking about other parts of the garden, what else is there in the garden that people can come and see here?
We've got a lovely formal garden, which is also our silent space. If anyone's seen any silent space other gardens, yeah, that's a lovely place to go because we like people to be quiet in there. So switch your phone off, not have any, you know, no distraction. It's a nice place to go and just sit and contemplate. So we've got a rose garden, we've got fritillary meadow, dock beds, we've got alpines, we've got saxifrage.
You've got quite a bit to look after here, Pat, haven't you, really?
Yeah,
it's
keeps
you busy.
I don't look after the saxifrage, I have to say, but everything that's sort of this side of the wall, we look after.
So do you have any particular favourite parts in the garden yourself? Where do you find yourself sneaking off to when you get 5 minutes?
I love to go down by the river. I love that river walk. I love that river.
And that's on the other side of the bridge that we're standing at.
This bridge is perfect because at one side you've got the wild area and then you look over this side and then you've got that beautiful border.
And I think that's the contrast, just on one bridge. Look to the left here, the beautiful house, the borders, and then to the right, the river, and that lovely wooded area. So what might you find in the wooded area in other parts of the season?
There's quite a few snowdrops in there, quite a few ancient snowdrops. There's a few daffodils, some very old fritillaries. We've got a fritillary meadow, but the really old ones are along by the river and they're always the first ones to come out. So it's more of a spring border, really. Mm.
And you can hear the birds in the trees. What other wildlife do you get in the garden?
We've got deer, we've got badgers. Rabbits, we've got squirrels, you name it, we've got it.
So as a gardener, you have those to contend with as
we
well.
Do. So
it's lovely to have wildlife in the garden. And haven't you seen an otter?
Yeah,
in
I
the
did
river?
In the winter. The river was quite high and it was at the end of the week on a Friday and I just thought, I'm just going to go down to the river, and I got my phone out and I started to do a little video. I started to just pan along the river and then I sort of heard something and I didn't really look at it, and then when I looked back at my little film, a little otter popped its head up.
Wow, incredible. Have you got your own garden, Pat?
I have got my own garden, yes. I try to go out maybe for an hour in the evenings in the summer, and I try to do as much as I can at the weekends, but my daughter's both bought me an egg chair. And so I like to sit in that.
But actually, do you know, I've seen an egg chair for the very first time this week and sat in it. Oh, it's lovely, isn't it?
It's so lovely, yeah. So that was a surprise birthday present. So I do a lot of sitting at the weekend and looking at my garden.
But I'm a big advocate, and I will say this time and time again, you need to sit in a garden to enjoy it.
To enjoy it.
But invariably, we all sit down, and then after 2 minutes, you see something that needs to be done. But it is nice just to sit down and contemplate and enjoy the fruits of your labour.
It is. I feel under a little bit of pressure with the front garden because obviously being the head gardener at Waterbury, it can't look a mess, can it?
So expectations are high.
Quite high, and unfortunately it's like a little mini section of the herbaceous border, so I don't have to do too much to it, but that's quite floriferous at the moment. It's that's coming along nice. But
so in terms of your own personal choices, do you have any particular favourite colours or plants in your garden or the garden here at Waterbury?
I am a cottage garden lover, so I love all the herbaceous. I love delphiniums, I love peonies, I love roses.
Yeah, and I have to say the peonies look beautiful.
Fantastic,
further along the border
they?
There absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah.
So any particular colours?
I quite like pink and purple.
Yeah, I go with the purple thing, definitely,
Oh, but I like everything, because I can never understand, you know, a lot of people don't like yellow, do they? And they won't have yellow in their borders.
I know, people get quite snobby about yellow, don't they?
Yeah, and I just think every colour is welcome.
Well, again, looking back at the herbaceous border, there are yellows in there, and the shrubs and the conifers.
Yeah, isn't it? Yeah.
Gives it a bit of light and shade, doesn't it? What's your favourite time of the year in a garden?
Oh, that's a difficult one. I guess it's May, June and September. But I do like all seasons because, you know, there's something, you're doing something different in every season. Mm. So, but I particularly like those ones. I think the border looks amazing now. And, you know, again in September, it will look, it's a very late colour, lots of late colour in the gardens.
And what about autumn colour? Because you've got a small arboretum.
We have, yeah. So we're trying to get more and more trees. We've got a few acers here. And, yeah, we're trying to get a little bit more colour. That's sort of future. And we're always thinking about what we're going to leave for the future as well. So.
Well, I was going to talk about the future. How do you make decisions and who's responsible for making decisions about how we're going to change the garden to lead the garden through to the next generation?
I guess we haven't really thought about that. Rob and I are just still, well, we think we're, you know, we're still young and we're
immortal. We'll be immortal, here forever.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess we will have to think of that at the time, but...
And is that ultimately yours and Rob's decision, or do you need to speak to Simon about your plans?
Yeah, we would probably talk to Simon about that.
Yeah. So the garden is open all year round, almost.
Yeah, we have a week between Christmas Eve and then we open again on January the 2nd.
Well, I, for one, will definitely be coming back because this is my first visit today. And I have to say, it's just beautiful.
Thank you.
We've got a perfect day, yeah. But to come back and see the long border change, to see the snowdrops in the winter, to come back and see the asters, I'm so excited. It's been such a lovely day. So thank you for your time today, Pat.
You're very welcome. And it's lovely to finally meet you.
And you too. It's been a long time coming, hasn't it?
We've
been chatting for a long time on Instagram. So lovely to meet you at long last. And thank you.
Thank you.
After chatting with Pat, I headed off to chat with Chris Lanchak, the fruit consultant, who showed me around the nerve centre of their fruit production area.
This is where you can see you get the smell of solder.
In there.
We'll see you through.
Oh yeah, I just got that.
Yeah.
That whiff of...
So, you get a couple of those barrels that go on top of there.
Yeah.
The juice is pumped through, left overnight, so the sediment goes to the bottom. That's a bottle filler, it's all apart at the moment. Basically, bottles go onto there.
So, that bit's done by hand, obviously.
That's done by hand.
Yeah.
This is an in-bottle pasteuriser. So, we then put 108 bottles into here, filled up with hot water, and it heats up to between 70 and 74 degrees. Mm-hmm. Just watch that door. Wow. 70 to 74 degrees for 20 minutes.
Okay.
And that's all that's required to pasteurise apple juice. And what that's basically doing is killing off microorganisms, particularly yeast.
Right.
Because if you just put the apple juice, bottle it, within, depending on temperature, within probably 4 to 7 days, it will start to ferment inside the bottle because the yeast will interact with the sugar. For cider, that's great. But you don't want it happening inside a closed bottle. Have you ever made homemade wine?
No.
Neither of you?
No.
Oh, so if you've ever made homemade wine, you know what I'm talking about. What happens is, if you get it wrong with homemade wine, you think, yeah, that's really the bottle now. And then it starts to ferment.
Right.
And the bottles aren't strong enough to cope with the fermentation.
So they'll explode.
Yeah, they explode.
So do you add anything to the apples in that?
The only thing we add to it in here, we add a very, very small amount of vitamin C.
Okay.
So it's 105 grams. No, it's not that, sorry. It's 55 grams per 100 litres, so very, 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 very small, very small amount. What that does...
And is that vitamin C in the
Ascorbic acid.
Okay.
Ascorbic acid,
right.
Powder. Yeah, pure vitamin C.
Mm.
What that does, it brings it back from a murky brown colour to a nice green colour. So it corrects the oxidisation.
Okay.
You know, if you cut an apple and you leave it for 5 minutes, it's gone brown. Hasn't it? If you're chopping up apple in a salad, most people usually squirt a little bit of lemon juice
over it.
It's just the same.
That's
same.
The same.
Yeah. Some people don't do it, and some varieties you don't necessarily need to.
Yeah.
Because they have a paler colour, but there are some varieties that if you don't do it, you know, you end up looking like it ends up with a bottle of juice that resembles the River Tyne in flood, you know.
Yeah, it needs to be...
It looks muddy.
Yeah, it needs to look appealing so people
are
going
to
take it off the shelf.
Yeah, it really does. Yeah, it really does. So we do that, and then, you know, then this goes on for about... It takes about 40 minutes to heat up and then get to cycle. So that's the slow bit.
You know, when I said to you I compress 3 or 4 of those barrels... Then it slows down.
Yes,
when it
this is where it slows up.
Yeah.
If I do 3 or 4, then Sam zero till about 11 o'clock at night. He's not too happy about it. And then a buzzer goes off and the tops go on. And the interesting thing is with juice, when it heats up, it expands. So you've got exactly 75 Cl has gone in because this is all
measured out
to do that.
Yeah.
It expands to the top of the bottle. And then when you put your top on, take it out, it cools down, it shrinks, you've got a nice little vacuum.
Wow.
And then it gets stored in the crates that you saw next door. Or we also make a lot of juice for other people.
And it's stored at room temperature, it's not chilled.
No. Once it's opened in the fridge for 3 days.
That's when you need to.
Yeah, because once you've broken that seal.
Yeah.
But it'll keep, once it's pasteurised, it'll keep 18, well, we put an 18 months sour boy date on it. But it will keep for... 2 years. The guy that helped me set this up, chap from the West Country, he was a food scientist for Eastmoreland Research, and he'd done analysis on apple juice after 2.5 years.
Mm.
And the vitamins were almost the same as when it was pressed.
Okay.
It hadn't changed much at all.
So you've got, did you say about 55 different varieties? Or
yeah.
Did you say 55 or 65?
65. Yeah.
So how many apples or what weight of apples do you need to make it worth putting it through the press in this process?
Right. You really need at least sort of 200 kilograms to put through to make a decent amount. So if we make juice for other people, we always ask them, can you bring at least 200 kilograms?
Yeah.
You know, which is I don't know, 10 or 12 decent sized carrier bags. And for that, they'll probably get 40 to 50
bottles.
Of juice. Yeah, depending on how juicy the fruit is.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. And what's your most popular one?
Well, Ashmead is certainly very popular and a good flavour, but the most popular is probably still Cox's Orange Pippin, purely because it's the one that people know.
Yeah, everybody knows that.
Everybody knows it. Yeah, they do. Yeah, but it is a lovely juice. We also, you know, because ours are all single variety, we make Bramley juice, and quite a lot of people actually like Bramley juice.
Mm.
You know, although it's pretty sharp. Quite a dry juice, but if you like grapefruit, something like that.
Yeah.
Because when we've done some of the shows, you know, people will come, oh no, I don't like apple juice. No, it's sweet. No, too sweet for me. So you try a bit of this. You're like, oh, that's really nice. You know, and they'll buy it. It's individual taste, isn't it? Yeah.
So, what's your personal favourite? If you had to choose,
I'd still be Ashmead Kernel.
It would be.
Yeah.
I haven't tried that one.
It's good. Yeah, we make juice. We from Discovery, which is the early apple, and that's the favourite of Raymond Blanc at Le Manoir.
That's the one.
They always take our Discovery, you know, and he loves it. But personally, I think it's one of the most bland juices. Yeah.
So where else do your bottled juices go to?
We sell to, I think we've now got about 15 customers, so all over the county. They go out to, say, Le Manoir takes some, the creamery over at Nettlebed, various farm shops.
Mm.
We did supply the Jacob Field pub chain,
right?
But of course, when all the pubs closed,
what
we found is that the sort of pub hotel side of it went away, but the farm shop trade went through the roof. So because farm shops have all been doing really well.
Yeah.
So we supply about 15 different people. Yeah.
We were talking earlier about the weather and the late frosts. T- Tell me again, how has your crop been affected this year by late frosts?
Well, this is the third year on the trot that we've not had a brilliant crop. So 3 years ago, we had a moderate crop because we lost some to frost. Last year, if you cast your mind back to the beautiful weather we had at the start of
lockdown,
the sun was shining and the trees were absolutely laden with blossom. And I did actually make a little film walking through, waxing lyrical about how lovely it all was.
Oh,
I won't be doing that again, ever.
I know where this is going.
And then it all set, and then we had a minus four in the middle of May.
Yeah.
And that caused the apples to all split. I mean, they then went from lovely apples to look as if they'd been grown in Chernobyl or something, you know. I mean, they really did. They looked awful. Right. So, but they were okay for juice.
Okay.
But for fresh fruit sale, they're not at all. Because they healed up and carried on growing, but they had lesions, funny shapes, you know. So that wasn't so good. And then this year, during the month of April, we had, I think it was 19 days where we had some kind of frost.
It was quite a prolonged period, wasn't it?
And when it wasn't frosty, there was a northeast wind. So that has really, really hit this orchard. So I think we probably only got maybe 10 or 15% of what we would normally have.
That's a big hit, isn't it?
It's made us think long and hard, because we're actually planting a new orchard. So originally we thought, right, okay, we'll go heritage varieties. And then we thought, well, we'll go heritage, but we'll look for varieties that have got good disease resistance, so we don't have to do so much spraying or anything else, you know. We're now looking at both of those, but we're also looking at ones that have got good frost resistance.
Yeah, because that's an expensive lesson,
and there are,
lesson,
and there,
isn't it?
It is, yeah. And there are one or two good of the good newer varieties that have been bred for, you know, for the organic market and stuff that do have good frost resistance. So that's now the way we're thinking for the future, because who knows? You know, who knows what's going to happen in the springs.
And you've got 5 acres of apple trees out there.
Yeah, yeah.
So how many people are working on those? 5 acres sounds a lot.
Well,
a lot of apple trees.
It is. Well, there's Sam full time who manages, Jules full time who's his assistant, and then me as their sort of fruit guru, and I'm 3 days a week.
Okay.
Yeah, a lot of pruning.
Yeah, that is a lot of pruning. So do you know how many trees you've got?
Yes, just over 1,200.
That is a lot of pruning.
Yes, a lot of pruning. Yeah.
And you've got your winter prune, and then your summer restricted prune.
Yeah. That doesn't take too long, because the cordons are only obviously only a few.
But how about the winter prune? How long does that take?
When
do you start? Right,
we like to start at least 2 weeks before Christmas. So juicing normally finishes end of November, maybe into early December for making some cider.
Mm.
When that finishes, we're straight out pruning. So we start December, and that'll usually take us up until the end of Feb, maybe just into March, depending on weather.
And obviously new people come along, they need to be trained to know how to prune.
Because
there is an art to pruning, isn't there?
There is an art to pruning, there is indeed. There is indeed. Some people can do it, and some just never get it.
Now, I know on Gardens World, Monty always talks about pruning trees. You should allow a pigeon to fly through. What would your guidance be on winter pruning of fruit trees?
Well, when I started here at Waterbury, which is a long time ago, with this orchard out here, they were much bigger trees. And the guy that taught me, he said, if you can take your cap off and throw your cap through the tree and it didn't land on a branch, you pruned it well. So that's the same as a pigeon.
Yeah.
But it's not so easy to get a pigeon, is it? So,
no.
You know,
it's easy to get a hat
you can throw through. Yeah.
So you're looking for open, like a goblet shape, or good air circulation?
In a garden, most definitely. Yeah. These trees here, most of these are what we call centre leader trees. So they've actually got a centre stem.
Yeah.
So it would be a bit of a challenge to throw a cap through. But we've also got some open centre trees, which is the goblet shape.
Yeah.
And those, they're slightly bigger trees on wider spacings. The only reason we go for the centre leader is we can pack a few more trees into the acreage.
Thank you, Chris.
Yeah, that's all right.
That's
welcome.
Really, you know your stuff, don't you? But it is like a family.
Yeah.
Everybody.
Like Chris is my daughter's godfather.
Yeah. His My daughter is your grandson's godmother.
And you are his... And the
it is a bit like the mafia.
It is. upset one of us.
You upset the whole.
I mean, we've known each other since we were kids, haven't we? So, you know, it's a big
odd family. That's lovely, though, isn't it? Yeah. Just, how often do you get to go to work somewhere?
No.
It's a family.
Yeah, we always go and have a cup of coffee together, and my brother joins us. It's just, you know, we look out for each other, don't we?
My dad came here in 1954. We worked here for Beatrix Havergal, you know.
Yeah.
In 1954. And I mean, this was all veg then. This was all, you know, like a garden.
Yeah.
I mean, very, very different place to, you know, what it is today. You know, it became a way of life for me, really. I used to go and work with Dad when I was about this high, you know.
So how old were you then, when you first started coming up here?
About 10, I think.
Yeah. So it's been there from a really early age.
Well, no, I think he worked out when I got to 10, I could be useful.
You're coming to work.
Yeah, that was it, yeah. Yeah, but it was, I think Beatrix Havergal would be amazed if she came back and saw it now. Because we had a shop in the Oxford Market then, and everything that was grown here was sold in that shop in the middle of the Oxford Market. This was pre-supermarket, you know.
So what are your memories of working alongside Beatrix?
Oh, gosh, yeah. She was a very, very formidable lady. I certainly remember that. But she had a very kind side to her, you know, and she was perfectionist. And that's probably rubbed off on all of us, you know,
what happens here now?
That have worked here, and those that were trained sort of in the earlier years after she retired. You know, I mean, the lady that used to run this department, Jean Manger, bless her, she's passed away now, but you know, that they were perfectionists, they really were. And time it didn't count.
No,
you did the job properly.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is a quality we don't seem to have these day and age. Everything needs to be done quickly.
It's finance, isn't it? Now?
Yeah.
I mean, it was a college then, you know, and there were students, you know, paying to be here. So that obviously helped with the finances. But it was all about, it was about perfection. It really, really was.
And she was ahead of her time, wasn't she? Oh, you know, sort of like a woman in horticulture back then.
Absolutely.
And setting up a school.
Yeah.
And she needed to be formidable, I guess, really.
Most definitely, yeah.
What do you think she'd think looking down now on Waterperry?
I think she would be delighted, actually. I think she would be absolutely amazed. Because she was a very good horticulturalist, I mean, superb horticulturist, but she was also a business lady. She was a shrewd lady, very shrewd lady. And I think she'd look at it now, if she could look down on a Saturday or Sunday when there's lots of people walking around the gardens now are, the ornamental part of the gardens are probably twice as big, if not more than twice as big than when she had it.
Yeah.
Because most of those gardens were under production for veg or fruit. Now there's a lot more going on. I think she'd be delighted. She really would.
A wonderful legacy that she's left you all, because the training and the standards, the perfection, it's all so evident here when you walk around.
Yeah.
And this is our first visit, and just a pleasure to come here really and see it all.
Good.
Just both, and for me, sort of like the fruit, which I don't normally do, the smell in here of the apples and just looking at the orchard. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you very much indeed.
Well, it's the end of our visit here today, and sadly we're on our way home, and we've seen so much. It has so exceeded my expectations. Just so much knowledge, so much passion, and so much for everybody to see here. I'm sorry to be going. It's just been the best day.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed this episode as much as I did visiting Waterperry and putting this together. My thanks to Pat, Simon and to Chris for their hospitality during our visit. It's a lovely, close-knit team and the most beautiful garden you could wish to visit. Definitely one to go on the garden visit wish list. And special thanks to Jo Tyler of So Niche Productions for her help with the outside broadcast at Waterperry and for holding my hand during my first ever podcast series. Thank you, Jo. And as I said earlier, this is sadly the last episode of the current series, but I will be back with series two before you know it. So have a great summer, enjoy your gardens, and if you wish to contact me, you can do so via my Instagram account, Mike_thegardener, or message me on the podcast email address, mikethegardener01@gmail.com, and that's Mike with an M-I-C. So see you very soon, everybody. Bye-bye for now. Bye-bye.